Avalon Center's podcast, Responding with Hope, is paid for by the Department of Social Services. Avalon Center offers emergency shelter, individual and group counseling, and much more to survivors of domestic and sexual assault. If you need help, call our 24-hour hotline at 833-537-0970 or visit us at avaloncenter.org.
Good morning. Hey guys, this is Leslie Jingleski, and we are recording our podcast today, Responding with Hope. And I am excited to be here today to welcome Dr. Elizabeth Lunsford. She is OBGYN in the Middle Peninsula with Riverside Partners in Women's Health. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here too.
Yes. So let's just kind of start off. How long have you been in medicine in Middle Peninsula?
I finished OBGYN residency in 2014, and then I moved to Gloucester. That's where the main location of my practice is, and I'm part of the Riverside Medical Group. So provide care to women on the Middle Peninsula, mainly in Gloucester, Matthews, and Middlesex. And then we deliver babies down in Newport News. So I've been here about 6 years now. This is my first job out of residency. I really love it.
Oh, I bet you do. I love the Middle Peninsula. Can you tell us a little bit about how you ended up working in medicine and why you ended up working in women's health?
Yes, I went to Virginia Tech after high school, and I always loved health. I always loved science. I loved having a practical skill to help somebody. And I got more serious about my Christian faith at college, and I just really felt like God was calling me to go into the medical field because I wanted to have a practical skill that I could help people with. And so when I was down there, I did some volunteering at a free clinic, and I did an OBGYN medical mission down to Honduras, and we did some surgery on women down there. And I really enjoyed, again, the hands-on aspect of OBGYN. I really enjoyed working with women's health because I feel like the issues surrounding women are very unique, and women are really the core of the family. And so I love my job. I get to help bring life into the world. I get to help women, you know, optimize their health so they can really enjoy their lives and enjoy their families. And then I get to also help them throughout the course of their lifespan. So all the way from, you know, when they're young girls, if they're having any problems, up to when they're elderly, you know, we see a wide range of patients. And we get to really follow them throughout their lifespan too, which is wonderful. So like some of the people I work with, I've only been in practice about 10 years now, but some of the nurse practitioners I work with have, you know, they're taking care of women now that they delivered, you know, when they were babies. Now they're in their 20s and 30s, and they're caring for them and helping deliver their children too. So it's really a unique field and very hands-on, and we get a lot of tangible feedback on how we're involved in people's lives. So that's why I chose OBGYN.
Oh my gosh. We're so thankful for you. As you know, that's amazing. Obviously, women's health is especially important when it comes to domestic violence and sexual assault. So I'm going to read a statistic. The national average is that 1 in 3 women experience sexual assault in their lifetime. Do you believe that that's an accurate statement locally?
I think that is. You know, I think people really are surprised by how prevalent it is. I've heard the statistic is that about 1 in 5 women are victims of sexual assault in their lifetime. And some people are really surprised to hear that it's that high. But again, if you think of over the course of your lifetime, I mean, unfortunately, women can be victims of that from, you know, young girls, teenagers, you know, all throughout their lifespan, their 20s, 30s. I mean, even elderly people can be victims of sexual assault. So, you know, that time frame really adds up, that a lot of people have had these really negative experiences. And again, because we're OBGYNs, a lot of people share those very intimate details with us, and we have to do these sensitive exams. And so as part of those exams, you know, we notice when people are very anxious about that exam, or if they have, you know, sometimes they have physical effects as a result of that trauma. And so it brings the conversation to the forefront. So I definitely do see that in practice, you know, and that's just the 20% is just of sexual trauma. But then you add in all the other forms of abuse, you know, not just sexual, but, you know, emotional abuse and physical abuse and financial abuse and all these different things can really add up. So, yeah, I think that statistic definitely is accurate. And it's good for women to hear that so that they don't feel like they're the only one that's suffering, and so they don't suffer in silence.
I agree. And talking about it, just having a conversation about it and bringing that awareness can, like you said, can kind of help with people who think they are maybe alone and they're not. So, and I can imagine, I know with my OB that she knows intimate details about my life, and I'm sure thankful for her. So I know that your patients are super thankful for you.
Mm-hmm. Intimate partner. And we really try to screen people. I mean, that's part of our standard evaluation that we're supposed to screen for at the annual exams, and also part of our new OB intake. We are supposed to ask about domestic violence, or the new terminology, intimate partner violence. Right. We do really try to ask about that at the intake visits. And again, I guess I'm surprised and also not surprised that when you ask about it and you do it in a non-threatening kind of way, a lot of people do share these, you know, sensitive topics with us. So we ask pretty directly because that trauma affects their gynecologic health. And so, you know, we find a lot of people that have had that kind of trauma, and we try to help them through it.
That's great. While we're talking about intimate partner violence, this statistic was probably the one that hit home most with me. And intimate partner violence is thought to be the most common cause of serious injury to women, and it accounts for more than 50% of female homicides. Mm-hmm. So that being said, prevention and early intervention, we know, is just so important. So can you talk to me about the role of the women's health provider? And we kind of already touched on your screening, but do you have policies and procedures in place that kind of help for a suspected victim of domestic violence?
To be honest, I don't think we have a formal policy written down, but we do get education about intimate partner violence, and we try to educate the staff about it. So once a month, I do a staff education, and one of our topics has been intimate partner violence and the local resources available, such as Avalon. So Leslie actually came and helped us. And, yeah. You know, I think the local resources are really the best resource that we have to get people connected to help, you know, because, again, that practical aspect of help. So we do have that. We certainly do, like I said, we screen for it. If we find patients that are in the midst of that, we try to assess, you know, their acute danger. Some of the risk factors that have been associated with increased danger to a patient are things like, you know, if the perpetrator is being violent to children or violent outside the home, or if they're, you know, threatening to kill the victim or the children, or escalating threats. Mm-hmm. If they're using drugs, if they're being abusive during pregnancy, you know, unfortunately, one of the top causes of death in the third trimester is homicide from domestic violence. And I've seen some, not death cases, but I have seen some trauma cases in women that are pregnant. And I think that always surprises people. But unfortunately, pregnancy is a big stress on the relationship. And in times of stress, we see domestic, you know, intimate partner violence increase. And so we also ask about in the home, if there are any weapons in the home, especially handguns. We try to assess their safety in the home. And then we help them try to figure out a safety plan. The safety plan are things like preparing the emergency kit, so they have their important documents and their keys and their money stored in case they need to escape urgently. You know, and then also having a set place to go, whether that be with friends or family or a shelter, somewhere they could escape to if they felt like they were in immediate harm. And then also if there are children involved, you know, having a plan with their children, and also with the neighbors if they need to call for help for 911, they need outside assistance. And then also a general guideline is, you know, if you're in an escalating conflict, you want to try to avoid being anywhere with potential weapons, like in a kitchen with knives, or you want to also avoid being in a room with an increased risk of injury, like a hard bathroom floor, where you might fall and hit your head on the floor on a sink. So some of those things we discuss with patients. And again, people are very, there are a lot of different situations out there. I mean, I never try to judge someone for why they wouldn't leave a situation, because, you know, I've seen firsthand, you know, reasons why people don't immediately leave. So I understand, you know, they're kind of different. There are different phases when people are considering making changes in their lives, and we're also trained on the different phases of making a change. So some people are still pre-contemplative. You know, they don't think there's a problem. Like, they might report that, you know, occasionally my partner, you know, screams at me or hits me, but they don't think it's a serious problem, and they're not thinking about making a change. So they're kind of still in the pre-contemplative stage. And then you have people that are contemplative. So this is the person that's considered making a change, but they're just not quite ready to take action yet. So they've at least thought, okay, something's wrong, I want to make a change, but they're just not ready to take action. And then people reach the determination phase. That's where they've decided to make changes in their situation. They've thought, you know, I have a plan, you know, I'm saving up, I'm getting my documents ready, I have a place to go, I'm going to make a change, and then action. And that's where a person is actively seeking help and taking steps to address the intimate partner violence. So those are kind of the four stages, you know, pre-contemplative, contemplative, determination, and action. And patients are at different phases along that spectrum, you know, and so sometimes people just want to share with someone what's happening. They want to talk through the risks. They want to talk through the safety plan. You know, other times they're getting closer to taking action steps. And so we definitely want to connect them with resources like Avalon that can help them get further along, you know, towards leading a safe and healthy life for them and their children.
Yeah, I think that probably the biggest question that I get asked on when I do these presentations for Avalon is, I don't understand, why won't the abuser just leave the situation? And I will tell you, that's not my favorite question, because, and as Juanita Graham says all the time, the more important question is, why is the abuser abusing? Okay. But there are many answers to that question, and we do see it all the time. But even with a resource like Avalon, who is there for the community and responds to the community, it is, you have to sort of walk a mile in her or his shoes and understand that abuser is not abusing the victim all the time. It's ups and it's downs. And it's interesting to me that, as far as the community goes, you're asking them many times to go to a communal shelter, and that's a very hard thing to do. That's a hard pill to swallow. So it is in the many times they do, we have survivors that come to the shelter and then they end up going back to the abusive situation, which we hate. But when they are ready to leave, when that person is ready, and we actually meet them where they are on many occasions. And just, you know, when they're ready, and it's that form of empowerment, it's talking to people like their OBGYN and creating safety plans and making that decision to leave when they are ready to leave. So I think you touched on that, and we appreciate you.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there can be multiple different reasons why people don't take the action step or get to the action step and then, you know, go back to their other relationship. I mean, it's, I think of it almost like quitting smoking, you know, there's different, it takes a while, you know, sometimes people try for a while, then they go back to it, then they try again. But I mean, it can be, you know, fear of harm, the threats, it can be financial, it can be the children, it can be, you know, all different sorts of things that keep people in those relationships. So I completely agree, you know, and And I think it's important too to know, for people to know out there, that, you know, we don't have a mandatory reporting requirement. Like, we don't have to report this to the police when you tell us that you're in an abusive situation, unless children are being abused. So if children are being abused, there is a law saying that we have to report that abuse. Or if the elderly are being abused, we have a reporting requirement for that. But in general, if you're, you know, not a child and not elderly, we don't report that. We don't have to report that. We do document that in our notes. So you may want to be careful about what access your partners have to your electronic medical records, which is kind of a whole different topic, you know. Sure. But it will be written in your notes, what you tell us, and if we see any injuries, because sometimes that comes back in legal documents as well, if any of this goes to court and needs to be, and we just have a requirement to write that in our notes. But we don't have a requirement to report this to the police, because I think that that might increase violence in some situations if we had to report that. And again, we don't want patients to feel like they don't want to tell us because they don't want to tell the police and then have it come back to their relationship. So we don't report unless it's children or the elderly that are being abused.
Gotcha. Well, and while we're kind of talking on that, we touched on the stress of relationships and how it makes abuse harder. And I know at Avalon, we're seeing our calls are up 50% because of the pandemic. So one of the things that we're worried about, and you can probably touch on this, is there any advice that you would give to women who are stuck at home with their abusers right now?
That's a good question. I know everyone was joking about the baby boom that would come, you know, nine months from now, because everybody's home. And we do sometimes see that if there's a snowstorm and everybody's home. But, you know, I don't think anybody expected the pandemic to be quite as long lasting as it has been.
And we did not.
As you were saying, Leslie, I mean, certainly there's been a lot of stressors this year. We've seen anxiety and depression rates go up exponentially. Because again, financial stressors, people losing their jobs, people being home all the time. So my advice would be to just try to optimize your own health. You know, I mean, you can't control everybody else at home with you. You can't control sometimes how other people treat you, but you can control yourself. Like, you can try to get good sleep at night. You can try to eat healthy. You can try to exercise and get outside, you know, for at least 30 minutes a day. I mean, the recommendation is to get about 150 minutes a week of aerobic exercise. And that really helps people get rid of tension and stress in their body. Yes. And it really helps depression. You know, aerobic exercise helps as well, like equally as effective as antidepressant medications do. Wow. So I think, you know, if people can really try to prioritize getting exercise, that will help them be happier and make them more resilient to stress. Some people do things like yoga, you know, and prayer and faith-based activities. And we can still do a lot over Zoom. You know, you can do a church meeting over Zoom, you know, and really find those outside, that network of relationships, even outside of your immediate family, can really help you, again, with resilience. And then also give you more support. So, you know, if things get worse in your relationship, you might have somebody to go to that you could depend on for help. So again, we can't always control how other people are acting or how they're treating us. But I think we have to take responsibility for our own health. And health is multifaceted. You know, it's like I said, it's sleep, it's nutrition, it's exercise, it's stress management, it's relationships. You know, it can be very isolating. Like, I think a lot of people got depressed this year because they're isolated at home. But again, if you can take opportunities to be proactive, maybe go for a walk with somebody outdoors, you know, wear a mask. I mean, there's pretty low risk of exposure with that. And then I encourage people to get the vaccine as well once it becomes more available. You know, I think it's good to get the vaccine for your own health. And then also, again, just so that you have more ability to get back outside the house and not have to worry as much about contracting COVID. So that's what I would say for this new life that we're in right now in the midst of the pandemic.
We are. And I will say on a positive note, though, as this pandemic has been tough, but we do have, a lot of us do have access to Zoom. You and I are communicating via Zoom. And I do feel fortunate that we live in a time where, while it's not the same, as talking face to face, but we do have the opportunity to get on a Zoom, we can get outside, and we have the communication tools to at least talk to people. I know Avalon, we have implemented an entire remote-based treatment or counseling services that it's all remote, and that's not gonna go away. So we have changed, we will soon get back to in-person, but what we have found with a lot of our survivors is that it is easier to be able to talk via remote and when you have kids and transportation and life happens. So I do believe that in the end, we will be better for this. You know, obviously we need to get back to social and human contact, but
yeah,
I think we're moving right in the right direction.
Absolutely. Yeah, we found, just as a side note, with our Riverside group, we're going to start offering virtual group prenatal care. So I think that will be really neat for the patients, you know, where we'll have a group of about 10 pregnant ladies and we'll have Zoom meetings. We'll give them a kit to check their blood pressure at home and check the baby's heartbeat at home, but then we'll be able to do group education on a virtual setting.
Oh, that's fantastic. Especially in a rural setting. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, that's exciting.
Yeah, and hopefully we will include some intimate partner violence, you know, in part of that group education setting. Because again, a lot of people are at higher risk of that while they're pregnant. And yeah, there's, again, a lot more pressure on the relationship during that time.
Oh, wow. So we, in the Middle Peninsula, we have volunteers that offer hospital accompaniment when there is a survivor of sexual or domestic assault and they go to the emergency room. And this is an important step for chain of custody when it comes to evidence for a case. Can you talk about this process at all at Riverside as far as how that goes and you know, any advice that you have?
I will say I'm not quite as intimately involved in this because I'm not an emergency room physician, but I know that they do have the emergency room doctors do have phone numbers to call, and there are certain nurses that are trained in helping victims of sexual assault. So I know they contact one of those nurses, and just as you said, the nurse will the nurse, but also an advocate, I think, is contacted so that there's an advocate there to just help them and give them assistance and support to get through that time. And then they have certain special nurses that are also trained to collect evidence that in case the person wishes to press charges in the future, that evidence will be acceptable in court. So I know that system is in place. I just haven't personally been involved in that since it's mainly an emergency department situation. Right. We do a lot of follow-up care though after sexual assault. You know, I will just say is if someone experiences a sexual assault, you know, they'll be offered STD treatment, but then it's important to also come back in about 3 months after that and get rescreened again and get retested, because sometimes it will not show up immediately. So you want to really get tested 3 months after and make sure that everything is negative. And then of course, follow-up care as well. You know, once we see patients back, we ask them how they're doing emotionally, if they need to see a counselor or anybody like that. So it's important. Yeah. Now you're treated in the emergency room to still come back and see your OBGYN in 2 to 3 months after and again, get retested for STDs and make sure everything is negative.
Good. And, you know, especially in the Middle Peninsula, it's a small and wonderful community. We've talked about this before, and we're so thankful to have access to women's healthcare providers like you. Oftentimes women that are in abusive relationships are afraid to talk to someone for fear of retaliation. And if you don't mind, talk about the importance of the doctor-patient confidentiality and what are some tips for a survivor that can make sure the conversations are not shared with their abuser, who tends to always be there, always around.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, confidentiality is really important to us. It's actually been a little bit easier with COVID because now all the visits, we don't allow visitors to come to the visits. So unless it's absolutely essential to the person's care. So for instance, somebody with dementia, we would allow someone to come in for that visit. But in general, all the other office visits are just one-on-one, the provider and the patient, which has been easier for us to gather information from the patient, for them to feel like they can share more openly. Because before, some of the warning signs would be if the partner came in to the office visit, you know, was acting very overprotective, and mm-hmm. it's kind of awkward to try to get them out of the room without creating problems. Right. So it's actually been easier for us to talk freely with patients in the room. And then as I was mentioning before, actually just this past year in 2020, there was a new regulation passed that patients have total access to their medical records. So through the electronic medical record portal for Riverside, it's called MyChart, you know, patients can sign on and see all the documentation of their office visit, which again, I think is a wonderful thing. But again, you have to be very careful if you have a partner that's abusive, that he maybe doesn't have that password to get in there and see what's written in the medical record so as not to exacerbate that situation. We do have an option to hide the note, but we have to say very clearly in the record that why we're hiding it. So if you want your OB provider not to share the note, you'd have to very specifically request, like, please do not share this note. And then we would be able to do that. But our default now is to release all the records to the patients. And then when you sign in, they'll also ask you who you want on your HIPAA form. And the HIPAA form is basically saying, like, who we can discuss your medical information with. So again, if you don't want that discussed with your husband or your partner or whoever your intimate partner is, you have to not put them on there. And we have had situations where sometimes partners get very upset, you know, if they're not listed on the HIPAA form. But again, that's your decision. You know, we're going to ask you and support you in whatever you want done. So those are some of the confidentiality issues that we've seen come up, and how we've kind of assessed that and tried to deal with that.
And I think it's good for women or men even when they go into the doctor's office to kind of have a game plan and know in their head how they want to handle that. So, you know, hopefully the right person will hear this podcast and know going into their, you know, how they want to do that. So I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
So this month is Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month, and we're talking about the importance of education and healthy relationships. Can you talk to me about the importance of a relationship between a young woman and her doctor, specifically when it comes to teenage girls and honesty about their relationships and sex?
Mm-hmm. Well, I get asked a lot, at what age should a young woman come to the gynecologist office?
Yes.
And so we are asked that question quite a bit. And I usually give the answer that the American College of OBGYN recommends somewhere between the age of 13 and 15 that a young woman come in and establish care with a gynecologist. And established care doesn't mean that we're doing a physical exam. We actually hardly ever examine young girls. We only examine people once they're 21. We'll examine them sooner if they're having any specific concerns about their health, like abdominal pain or vaginal discharge or breast issues. But until 21, we usually don't do physical pelvic exams. But, you know, between the age of 13 and 15, if they come in, we talk to them about their menstrual cycles. We talk to them about whether they are or plan to become sexually active. We talk to them about the Gardasil vaccine, which is a vaccine that prevents cervical cancer. We kind of assess, or we do assess, you know, their safety and relationships, and if they're using, if they've used any alcohol or drugs or anything like that. So we talk in general with them and just tell them, you know, establish that relationship. So if something does come up during the year that they have concerns with or problems with, they can easily reach out to us. And again, all of that care is confidential. So we don't share that with their parents. That's protected under confidentiality laws specific to teenagers. We do try to spend some time alone with them. So a lot of them will come in with their parents to start with. And then as part of our routine care, we say, you know, we'd like to talk to all teenagers alone. And we ask the parents to go to the waiting room. And most parents understand that. And so then in that time alone, then we would ask them if they're in any relationships, if they're safe in their relationships, if they've ever experienced any trauma or abuse in the past. And again, it's, you know, as you develop that relationship, I think people feel more open and more ready to share with you. Mm-hmm. So that's why it is nice for young women to kind of establish a gynecologist, because I can tell you there's a huge difference between the first time I see somebody 1 year and the second time I see them the next year. You know, once they know that, you know, we're here to support them, we're here to help them, the second time they come back, most of them are much more open and share much more information with me. I mean, some people share initially right off the bat, but I think most people, it takes a little time to warm up. Part of our general screening for teenagers is asking about that, about those, if they're in any traumatic or, intimate partner violence type of relationships.
Yeah. That's good information, especially, I personally am a mother of a 13-year-old daughter, and it brings its own challenges with communication, and you do want the best for them. So however they need to talk, I think is great. There's a dynamic between a parent and a child that is much different. That's really good information. I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And you are on our Avalon's advisory board for the Middle Peninsula. And you've done so much for Avalon, and I don't think we ever can tell you how much we appreciate what you have done. But you have a special place in your heart for domestic abuse. And I just wanted to know if you were interested in sharing your story that might help other people.
Yeah, sure. I heard about Avalon a couple years ago, and I wanted to get involved, not only because of my work, because I've seen, you know, many patients struggle with intimate partner violence. And I wanted to know as much as I could about the resources that were available in the community so they could get connected. And so we'd have a good way to refer people, you know, for that help. So that was one of the motivations. But I also think back, I had to my childhood. So again, a lot of people, you know, judge by the exterior, by the cover. And I don't think most people would suspect that I had the kind of childhood I did. But I grew up in a family that my stepfather was emotionally and physically abusive to myself and to my little sister and my mother. And so it was just a very hard childhood. Like my father died when I was a little girl. My mother remarried when I was about 3 years old. And I think she remarried kind of quickly because she wanted help with her young child. And, you know, she married somebody that promised the world to her that, oh, I'll take care of you, you know. And we, at the time, we were living in New York. But then after they got married, he wanted to move her down to Virginia to kind of move her away from her support network. And again, that can be kind of a warning sign of abuse, you know, when people are taken away from their ties and they're being isolated. So we moved down to Virginia, around Charlottesville, and we moved out to the mountains, and we were like way out in the country, right. Had very few neighbors. And my stepfather, he was from Thailand, and his culture, I don't know, it's hard to know whether it was the culture or whether, I think he actually had some psychiatric issues too. I think he had some paranoid psychosis. Now that I'm a physician, I can look back on that and see that. But so from when I was 3 until I was 13, we lived with him, and he was, you know, just very paranoid, very controlling, you know, abusive. He wouldn't, I don't know, just strange things. Like, he didn't want me to do well in school. So when I was in like third or fourth grade, I'd bring home a report card and he'd say, oh, you're just showing off. You're just trying to show off, you know, you think you're better than other people. And I'm, you know, 9 or 10 years old. So I was just trying to study and do well, but he wouldn't let me be involved in any sort of activities. He wouldn't let me go to anybody's house. I couldn't do anything on the weekend. We couldn't go to church. I mean, he just basically wanted us to do nothing outside of the house and nothing outside the home. And he was just also very violent. Like I just remember feeling scared to come home every day because I wouldn't know when he would explode or be violent. Wow. And so I lived in fear for 10 years, you know, and again, I think people say, well, why didn't you leave? Why didn't your mother leave? Well, we didn't have a lot of money. You know, we owned a restaurant together. So their main source of income was this restaurant in town, a small burger restaurant. Mm-hmm. And I mean, my mother was a housekeeper. She didn't have a college education. You know, we just didn't have the resources to leave. And he was threatening. You know, he would say, if you leave, I will kill you. I will kill my grandfather. He was threatening to kill them. We thought he was crazy enough that he would do that, you know? So we honestly were very scared to leave. And then my mother had a child with him. So I had a half sister who was 5 years younger than me, but her father was this man. And so again, it's very complicated when you get children involved. You know, I think my mother knew that he would want custody of his daughter and he would want her to be with him. So I think that also kept her in the marriage a lot longer than she would have stayed. And, you know, it might sound silly, but we had a lot of pets. We had a lot of animals, you know, and I think that, you know, sometimes people don't leave relationships because they're worried about their pets and what will happen with the animals. So we stayed in that, or she stayed in that marriage for about 10 years. And like I said, I just grew up with a lot of fear and a lot of anger. And, When I was 13, we finally escaped from him. Something happened in our family. He got very violent. We finally called 911. And then I think my mother was so embarrassed that the neighbors knew about that she wanted to try to get away from him. So we had to hide out for a few days in a hotel. We had a protective order, you know, the whole nine yards. And we lived in fear for a couple of years that he might retaliate and do something. But fortunately, I think he wanted time with his daughter, so he didn't want to go to jail. So he kind of let us separate and let us go. But it took a lot of courage for my mother to get out on her own, you know, and she was able to start cleaning houses and get us, you know, stable. They had sold the restaurant at that point. So anyway, you know, so that's why I never judge anybody who's still pre-contemplative or contemplative, you know, and they're not ready to take action yet, because I know there can be multiple layers of why people stay in those relationships. And, you know, I totally forgive my mother. I know she was doing the best she could at the time, but I just thank God that, you know, I have not gotten into abusive marriage like that, because a lot of it can be generational. But that was my story. So I think back and I think, wow, I wish there had been a group like Avalon out there to give us some resources and give us some support, you know, give us a place to stay. I mean, fortunately, we had enough money that we could stay at a hotel for a few days until we got a rental house. But it was, it was kind of a dark period of my life. And so, but, you know, there's hope and forgiveness and restoration. And I'm just, like I said, I'm very thankful for where I'm at today. And I feel like the Lord has used all that to give me more compassion towards people that are suffering through those experiences.
Yeah, your story is one that truly deserves to be celebrated, because you are absolutely a survivor. Your mother is a survivor. And I truly appreciate you and all that you've done for Avalon. And I hope somebody hears your story. And is there any advice that you would give women and children who are experiencing abuse now?
I think just try to think of options. You know, don't feel like you're stuck. Don't feel like there's no other way. There's no way I can get out of this. Because I remember back a moment in my childhood, I think I was about 10 years old, and I remember my mother and I talking and saying, like, we felt like we were in prison, like we had no way out. There was no way out. And my mother said, well, at least you'll get out when you're 18. And I have a life sentence, you know?
Right.
I mean, I can kind of, just thinking back to that moment, like, we were in prison. I mean, we had options. We had a way to get out. It takes a lot of courage to do that. And so again, I think just try to think of options or how could you do this? And there's not always one right way to get out. But just try to think through like, what are my resources? What are my family options? What are my other career options? What do I need to do to take those baby steps so that if things do get worse in my home, you know, I don't have to suffer through this in silence, and I need to protect my kids, and I need to set a good example of what's a healthy marriage, a healthy relationship for my children, you know? So just try to really think through that and don't feel like there's no hope or there's no other option. And just be brave. You know, I think courage is really lacking, and, you know, pray for bravery, be brave, you know, listen to stories of survivors and of how people have gotten out of those relationships. And then when you're ready, you know, take those action steps, because there's a whole nother life you could be living where, you know, nobody should come home and have to be afraid. I mean, home should be a place of peace and harmony and joy where we get restored. So then we can go out to face the world. But home shouldn't be a place of fear. You know, I mean, that's just not how it's meant to be.
I agree. And I appreciate you so much. And I hope that your story, it helps, you know, one person. I know it will. You are an inspiration to all of us. We appreciate you. We appreciate what you do for Avalon. And I hope you have a good day.
Oh, thank you so much, Leslie. You too.
Thanks so much. You take care.
Avalon Center's podcast, Responding with Hope, is paid for by the Department of Social Services. Avalon Center offers emergency shelter, individual and group counseling, and much more to survivors of domestic and sexual assault. If you need help, call our 24-hour hotline at 833-537-0970 or visit us at avaloncenter.org. Avalon Center's podcast, Responding with Hope, is paid for by the Department of Social Services. Avalon Center offers emergency shelter, individual and group counseling, and much more to survivors of domestic and sexual assault. If you need help, call our 24-hour hotline at 833-537-0970 or visit us at avaloncenter.org.